6:40, or 6:40. 6:40 PM. Today is Tuesday, May 30, or May 1, 2007.
It's 5:40.
Yeah, 5:40. It's 6:40 in Seattle, though.
That's right.
Yep.
Let me correct that. Time is 6:40, and it's May 1, 2007.
5:40.
It is 5:40. Clerk, you got that straight?
And it's Monday.
Is the chairman in a time, a different time zone?
We have Representative Gatto, Coring, Dahl, some guy to my right. We'll call him Dugan, and Representative Newman.
As usual, the chairman's an hour ahead of the rest of us.
Power of the chair. Let the record reflect, we have a quorum. First on the agenda is a presentation by Walter Sampson. Walter's the Vice President of Lands and Resources for NANA. He's here this evening to talk about Red Dog and its economic impact on Northwest Alaska. Following the presentation, we're going to have a hearing on Senate Bill 97, frequently referred to as the Silver Hands Bill. It has to do with the native art in the state of Alaska. Sponsor of this piece of legislation is Gary Stevens, Senator Gary Stevens. Walter, go ahead. And I asked Walter earlier what works best for him. So if the committee has questions, just raise your hand, and we'll try and get to you as the presentation goes along.
Thank you very much, Chairman Representative Newman. First of all, I want to thank you for the invitation to come and to talk about the economics of the Northwest area. More specifically, Red Dog, yeah.
Can you state your name and affiliation?
Yes, okay. My name is Walter Sampson. I'm the Vice President of Land and Resources for NANA Regional Corporation. And I've been with the company 34 years. And certainly, it's been an interesting 34 years.
Thank you, Walter. I just have to make sure that Representative Lynn and Johansson are recognized. We do have Representative Jewell in the audience. Reggie, if you'd like to come join us up front, feel welcome. Thank you. Go ahead, Walter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I will try to attempt to do is to give you a quick snapshot in regards to how Red Dog has certainly benefited the Northwest region. I'm talking about the NANA region. But before I go into my presentation, I would like to give you a quick brief history in regards to the NANA region. When the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was passed in December 1871, the 11 villages that represents the NANA region all indicated to NANA that all their lands that they're selecting will be based on subsistence use pattern. The subsistence use patterns basically represent as their backyard for food. I'm talking to a lot of us, or to some of you that live in the urban communities. You go to Cars, Safeway, and other areas to pick up your food. This is certainly what was to the residents of the region. Their backyard was their Safeway. And being that, they said, whatever we do, however we do business, there will be no development within this region. Just like any country throughout the state of Alaska, as a rural community, majority of our communities were tribally controlled. And those tribes certainly had some kick on their governing body. By that, I mean they were a strong governing body. At times, when it comes to the point where people needed to be dealt with, in some cases, people were blue-ticketed out, more so to those that really were the problem. And that was the type of a government that run the communities. And of course, through the course of the year, eventually, all the 10 villages, all except for one, decided to become first or second-class city government. NOTAC is the only tribally-owned governing body within this region. Based on that, again, when the city governments came about, services started to come in. Back then, revenues to the city governments were such that they had revenues to work with. And we all know what's happening today. Through the service areas that the city governments provided, water and sewer came about. Electrification came about. The services for the utilities, television, telephone, and these services started to come into the region. One day, people started to realize that the dollars that they've been receiving, both from the state and federal government as a handout, also starting to be cut. Through that process, people saw the picture that they will no longer be provided those free dollars. Through the process of our annual meetings, I'm talking about NANA Regional Corporation, we go through our village meetings on an annual basis. Then once a year we have our annual meeting. Through the process of our village meetings, the shareholders starting to raise the issues in regards to finding a way to pay for these services that are now in place. And eventually at the annual meeting, at one of our annual meetings, that very same issue was raised with a directive to the NANA board saying, NANA, you need to start looking for something to create an opportunity for us. Otherwise, the services that's been provided to us, a lot of it is going to be lost. That's something NANA didn't know what it was that it was supposed to develop. At that time, NANA was also going through its process of finalizing its land selection. We certainly paid attention to the residents and start looking at our land selection. What is it that the shareholders have asked us to do? What is it that we have in the region that we can look at and develop it? We quickly went into backtracking our land selections. All the selections that we made, again, were based on subsistence use patterns. None of it was based on any resource. So we quickly started looking at some potential resource areas based on the information we only know from the region. Then one day, while we're doing that, there was an information that was provided to NANA in regards to some good potential resource north of Kotzebue. So we quickly got that information from a air taxi operator who is known as Bob Baker, who also does some work, flies around, look at resources and whatnot. At the same time, we also got information from USGS in regards to some staining that was occurring north of Kotzebue. So the interest was to look at that. At that point in time, we had some additional lands that we can also revise to our selections to look at selecting lands within that stained area, not knowing what that stain was. We moved ahead to make some selections anyway, because we thought that was a good potential resource that we can develop. And through that process, we hired a geologist to look at what that resource might be, take a look at, have him take a look at, see what the quality might be. As far as quantity is concerned, we didn't know either. We went and made a selection within that area and applied our 14HH selections of 77,000 acres into what we call Red Dog today. And that was the start of the process. But in order to develop that, we needed to make sure that we have full support from the residents of the region. Having selected those lands, we again went out to the villages, providing information to all the villages, saying that we have a possible future development within this area. They encouraged, with encouragement from all the villages, we moved ahead to start the planning process. From day one, we included all the villages through the process of planning, getting their viewpoints into and through that process. The two closest villages, Notak and Kivalina, being two closest villages to Red Dog Mine, we certainly paid more special attention to the two communities. Through that process of planning, we had to go through, for the road system, go through a monument, which meant that we had to go to Congress to get an easement. And that certainly took some time. From day one of planning for the Red Dog Mine, 14 years later, we started developing, or we started the development of the mine site.
Walter, let me interrupt for just a second. You mentioned,
Representative Gatto.
Thank you. You mentioned a stain, and then you call it Red Dog.
Right.
Is the stain red?
Right.
And so I'm just curious. Okay. Red Dog, help
me. Thanks for, thank you, Representative
Gatto.
Gatto. What that red stain was the staining of the rocks. And now Bob Baker, at that point in time, when he was going out doing his work here and there, had a red lab with him. And that lab was his closest friend out in the field. So based on that, we named the mine site Red Dog. Bob Baker's Red Lab Dog. So that's why the Red Dog's name is Red Dog today. Thank you very much. Now, once we went to Congress, I think our biggest fight was not that we have anything against the environmentalist groups. That was the stumbling block for us, was trying to get an easement on the monument. And that's where the fight really concentrated. And eventually, Congress gave us an easement through that monument. Then in 1980, of course, well, let me backtrack. When we finally got that easement, what we started also do was start hunting for a partner. Not having the knowledge of mining, we had to go out looking for a partner. We not only look at Alaska, we also looked outside Alaska. We looked at two possible partners. One was Kennecott, and one was Cameco. Cameco, having the mines in the Arctic on the Canadian side, we went over, looked at their operations. We also looked at Kennecott mines down south. And figured that if Cameco has a mine in the Arctic, in the way they do business, we thought they'd be a good partner. So we started having a dialogue with Cameco. It's just like you going out dating first time when you find your girlfriend. We started dating. And through the process of dating and having discussions, we finally got married with Cameco. And that was the turning point of development of the Red Dog Mine. Cameco, being the Canadian firm and having that Arctic experience, certainly was good for us. Once we signed an agreement with Cameco, that agreement certainly has certain provisions in there that I will address. And that's how we got into the mining industry. Just imagine, from your viewpoint, looking at who's talking to you today, from a traditional lifestyle of Inupiaq, now being an instant miner, certainly was a drastic change for me. Just imagine some of the elderly folks that trying to understand the industry, trying to understand what mining was all about, was certainly an education for them. In fact, that was the biggest things that we had to do, was to try to educate our people in regards to mining and how it operates. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would like to go into my presentation. As you can see, yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about the balance between subsistence and development?
Yes. When the Nana-Cameco agreement was signed as an agreement, there were provisions that were placed into that agreement that says that once the mine opens, along with that will be provisions to protect all resources within the mine area, within the road system, within the port facility. Based on that agreement, we also created what we call a subsistence committee from the two closest communities, from Notak and Kivalina. The subsistence committee was created through the elders council in each village. Nana nor Cameco did not pick as to who would sit on that committee. The elders themselves from the two communities chose who would sit on that committee. The committee itself are not employees of Nana nor Cameco. They're solely hunters. And their charge and their role is to make sure that the resources in and around the Red Dog Mine, as a road system and the port facility, would be protected. So on a quarterly basis, this committee meets. They get an updated report in regards to how the mine's doing. If they see there might be some potential impact on part of the mine or all the mine, they will go to the company and say, hey, you have a potential problem here. You need to fix that problem. One example is when the mine had some seepage problems on the early start. They noted that there was some seepage into the Red Dog Creek. The subsistence committee went to the company and say, you have a seepage problem. You need to fix that. Either fix it or shut the operation down. So Cameco had no choice but to spend an additional $12 million in fixing that seepage problem. And that's the type of an authority that committee had, and the relationship between Cominco, Nana, and the committee certainly is good. And as far as other studies are concerned, with the state of Alaska or with the federal government, we certainly work with those agencies as well. More so with Fish and Game out of Fairbanks. When studies are requested to be done, we support those studies. In fact, every 4 or 5 years, we try to work with the state in doing analysis on caribou, which meant that we would go out and shoot some caribou, take some meat, and do analysis on caribou on the road system, as well as the mine site system. Fisheries, we do the same thing. We encourage the state to continue to do that. We get involved in water quality study. So in whatever we do in regards to protecting resources, we certainly pay attention to that. So with that, I want to thank you. So with that, I want to get into the Red Dog Mine, an economic powerhouse in Northwest Alaska. The Nana region is represented by 11 communities. Again, NOTAC being the only tribally owned governing body, rest of the other 10 villages have city government. Kotzebue being the base and the hub for the region, Kobuk to the east 120 miles being the smallest community. As you can see where Red Dog is located, it's located closer to Kivalina and NOTAC. Under the agreement that we have with Tecumseh, there is a provision in there that also applies to employment committee. Employment committee consists of members from Cominco as well as Nana. And part of the thrust of that committee is to try to get our shareholders into some of the higher paying jobs. And in fact, our target for the Red Dog project is to become a 100% shareholder. We understand and recognize that we would not be able to reach that over the life of the mine, but that was the target. But through the process of education, we encourage our students to go into college, to go into technical schools, so they can become professionals in the areas of the mine site, metallurgy, or our supervisory in the mine site itself, or into manager positions. Through that process of education and training opportunities, Tecumseh also with Nana, we have what we call pre-employment education processes by bringing in students into the Red Dog Mine for career awareness. In 2006, we're able to bring in 38 students into the mine site.
Walter?
Yeah.
Representative Gatto has a question.
The students all come from Kivalina?
No. The students came from all the villages within the region.
And the reason I ask, I hope I'm not going to go too far afield here, but Kivalina had some serious problems with schools.
Yes.
Not that long ago, that required state troopers, it required
yes.
teachers to leave, new superintendents, and that sounded like a school district in disrepair.
Yes.
Has that been corrected so that you're now getting some students from Kivalina who are more interested in a career than in being troublesome?
Yes, that has been corrected, and in fact, like I told you early on, that we specifically concentrate more closely to Kivalina as well as NOTAC on all aspects of the issues to include education. So Tivolina is not excluded from anything we do at the mine site. We bring in from the community of Tivolina into Red Dog high school students as well. So it's not only from Tivolina, but all the villages in the region. So we do pay attention to Tivolina concerns as well. We also bring in students to job shadow. By that I mean we have different positions where some of these high school students will work with a manager at the mine site, with a supervisor, or right out in the areas where they actually work outside. So we have that program. We also work with a tech center in Cotsview under the Millwrights program, where students from all the villages come in and apply for Millwrights program, where they spent some time at the technical Cotsview Technical Center going through training. And on an annual basis, we take in at least 10 to 20 students through that process of training. We also have on a job training as well for some of the students that might be willing to do that. We have in place in Red Dog 6 trainers that can take care of that. We also have what we call a post-secondary scholarship program. We spent, when I say we, I mean NANA. NANA spends at least $250,000 on an annual basis for scholarships for any students in the region that want to go to college, that want to go to technical training, or any professional training that they would like to go to. We try to emphasize on the engineering side of the picture, because we certainly need the skills of engineers at the mine operation. So any high school students or a student that is serious about getting their engineering skills or engineering degree, we will pay for that student 4-year college to get their degree. If they need additional schooling, we will continue to educate them. Based on that, we have one engineer, a native engineer now, on site going through that process of education training. It's not only Red Dog that does this. We have other engineering firms within the NANA family companies that are also committed to sending students out to become engineers. So the scholarship program that we have, that's just one sector from NANA side. All the other entities also pitch into the scholarship. And we have a nonprofit organization called Akaluk Trust that deals with the scholarship program. As you can see on this picture, the students that we bring in from the communities. Here you can see a science class from NOTAC that had asked to go into Red Dog to look at water, more specifically, water quality studies. Assaying on some of the product that comes out of Red Dog. We bring these students in to take a look at what they can do on the science field. We also look at trying to maximize our shareholder employment. I told you earlier that our target is to become my 100% shareholder operation. As you can see, since 1996, we've been pretty much up and down down 51 to 58%. Part of our problem that we have, just like anywhere in the country, just like anywhere in the villages, we have problems with alcohol, drugs and alcohol. Red Dog is a drug-free, alcohol-free operation. if some of these folks that have been to Red Dog with their first paychecks gone home and came back to Red Dog and happened to be one of those that go through the test again and did not pass, then they're relieved from work. It's the problem that we also feel within our region, and we try to deal with it. And in fact, some of those people that get caught doing that, we have a program within the company that if you're willing to clean yourself up, we'll send you through a program. And that's the offer that we'll provide to some of these people.
And Walter, that's an interesting graphic right there, because when you look at the graduation rate in the state of Alaska, pretty close.
Yes, close. Certainly. And, you know, what the hopes is for the next 10 years is to increase that percentage even higher. Hopefully some of those students that are in college today will certainly will fill some of those positions at the mine site. The next slide is employment. As you can see, Tecumenco employs 360 people. Out of the 360 people, 54% of those are shareholders. Alaska residents, 83%. NANA Joint Ventures also has employees of 103, more specifically the catering and the trucking contracts that NANA has. Within those two companies, we have 64% of shareholders working for those two. The total workforce is 464, 56% of that being NANA shareholders. There's a little bit conflict between the 58% that I showed you and 56. I think this is more current percentage today. The total annual wage from the Red Dog last year was $42 million. I will show on the slide here how the wage cap is. The Tecumenco wages that are paid for non-shareholders and shareholders, as you can see on the red there, or the darker burgundy color, is a non-shareholder wage that was paid, somewhere about $18 million. And the shareholders on top, about $17 million last year. And that's the comparison between the shareholders and non-shareholders. This is just Tecumenco, not other contract work. Just Tecumenco wages that were paid. If you look at the total, that's from 1989 to 2006, $475 million has been paid as wages for the Red Dog mine by Tecumenco. Next slide shows you where the shareholders that work at the mine site reside. As you can see, Anchorage has a high spike. And there's a reason behind that. Just like any other villages throughout the state, two things. One is a cost of living in the community is high. Employment at the village is only limited to so much. Housing within the community is also a problem. So the shareholders that were hired from all the villages have certainly had migrated to Anchorage, because first of all, they can find a cheaper housing, and cost of living is much cheaper in Anchorage. That's why there's migration of the workforce from the mine site. And we don't have nothing against the shareholders doing that. It's their life. It's where they want to live. It's their choice.
And on that point, Walter, I know that I've talked to some folks
who have real concerns about the younger adults, you know, because they now are more employable, get jobs, moving out of the villages from what they've originally, where they lived. And there is still a large concern among some of the elders in the communities on that.
Yes.
Correct.
But even with that migration, the hopes is that large spike will certainly come down a little bit, because we saw some of those people that have moved into Anchorage starting to filter back to the communities. They saw that, well, they really can't live in an urban center where there's it's a big city to them. As far as the culture is concerned, our people are more bonded together at the village level. And that's one of those things that they miss by moving out. Not all of them are going to move back, but a good majority of them, I think, will migrate back to the village.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sampson, thanks for coming and telling us the story. I know that there's concern in some of the native corporations about the number of people who are now becoming young adults who are not shareholders, what I believe they call the afterborns now. Are there younger people who are working at the mine who don't show up in these statistics because they're not shareholders of the Nana Corporation?
Thanks for that question. The issue in regards to afterborns, where one of the two corporations that have enrolled are afterborns. Our original shareholder was somewhere about a little over 4,700. Mm-hmm. Today, we have a little over 11,000 shareholders. So those children that are born after December 18, 1971, are also enrolled today, because that was a question that was placed to the shareholders to vote on, and they voted to enroll those children, what you call afterborn. But they also have a different type of stocks. Their stocks are non-transferable, which means that if a child that was born after 71 has received 100 shares, if that child dies, those shares go away. So they sort of rotate on a circle like this. Mm-hmm. So all the children that were born on an annual basis certainly get enrolled to Nana.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The next slide is royalty payments. As you can see, that Nana receives a good chunk of money from Tecumseh as a royalty from 1982 to 2005, total of $126 million. Remember, as a regional corporation under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, there's provisions in there that says that we will share under 7I that the resources that we derive revenues from. So 70% of what we make, we share with 12 other regional corporations. In turn, they do the same thing. Northwest Arctic Borough. You all will probably recall some years back, the encouraging from the state of Alaska for some of the regions to become a borough. Nana region looked at that encouragement. because Red Dog is the only source of income and only resource deriving for this region. That was encouraging to us. Based on Red Dog, we thought this would be an opportunity to create a borough. So the discussions we had with the communities and what the borough could do for its communities to become an extension of a government closer to the state than they would be closer as a city government, we thought would be a good option. Based on the discussions that we had with the villages, we were encouraged to become a borough. When we moved ahead to become a borough, we based that on two areas. One, that we would become a borough to support education, and two, to create and to support an opportunity for employment for the residents of the Northwest region. And based on that, in 1986, we became a Northwest Arctic borough. Under the agreement that we have with Tecumseh, as you can see, PILT, it's PILT, we call it. This is the money that we receive in lieu of taxes from Red Dog. Payment in lieu of taxes is what they call it. Tecumseh pays the borough in lieu of taxes, so therefore the residents of the region do not pay any taxes. All the taxes come in from the Red Dog mine. Originally, the money that came in from the Red Dog was a pretty small amount. Today, our budget is $6 million. In 1996, I believe, trying to think of the dates, the residents of the Northwest region authorized the Northwest Arctic Borough to bond up to $100 million for schools. With what little revenues that we get from the mine site, to date, we've been able to construct 7 new schools within the region, within 7 villages. We do have 4 other villages that we have to deal with. Last year, MOTAC was online for the next school as a bonding package. Because we were maxed out on our bonding capacity, we were unable to bond MOTAC. So we went to the state of Alaska for grant for a new school in MOTAC. Over the 2 years that we've been dealing with, cost of living certainly has raised. The state of Alaska certainly allocated some dollars over the 2 year period because of cost of living and transportation cost has risen. This year, I know we were short of about $10 million. And the hopes is for the state to take care of that shortfall. If the Northwest Arctic Borough had enough capacity to bond the school, we certainly would have looked at that. And what we're hoping to do for the future, I will describe to you a little bit here on the next page. Based on the payments that we've received to date from the mine site, We've received $56 million through 2005. And we feel that we certainly had made good investment with those dollars that we have towards education. Good 80%, 85% of those dollars that we receive from the mine site goes towards education. And very little of it goes to the governing body itself. ADA, as you all know who ADA is, when Red Dog was being constructed, one of the problems that it had was financing, more so towards the deep port facility. We call it the port site. So Tech had to go to the state of Alaska for financing. And that was at that point in time the state of Alaska created ADA. Total ADA investment at the port site was $265 million. Out of that, the interest paid by Tecumseh, $190 million. Debt paid by Tecumseh of $15.5 million. The excess tonnage charges of $23 million. That's the tonnage fee for the road system that was set aside for emergencies, that $23 million. Total paid to ADA through 2005 has been $288 million. A couple of years ago, the Northwest Arctic Bureau started looking at to trying to find a way for additional revenue for the borough, because of the fact that we saw the need from the communities on a weekly basis. There's always a request from one of our communities to the borough to do certain things. We also saw the cuts that the state of Alaska has in regards to some of the services or some of the dollars that it gives out to some of the communities. Based on the need, the Northwest Arctic Bureau started looking at trying to find a way to purchase the DeLong Mountain Transportation Facility at the port site. 2 years ago, we attempted to have a dialogue with ADA. For 2 years, it seems like that we always hit a brick wall, unable to have a discussion with their board or with their administration. And it was just this fall, after the administration, new administration came in, we finally had a discussion with the ADA board and with the ADA administration in trying to find a way to purchase the DMTS facility. In fact, the Northwest Arctic Bureau went one step ahead to do our own evaluation with a contractor of the DMTS facility. And the hopes is to have that evaluation done by end of this month. Take a look and see what the cost might be. And if you look at what I said and listen to what I said early on, that the needs that we have for the villages, if we can purchase the DMTS, this is certainly would be an economic boost, an opportunity for the residents of this region as far as services are concerned, or opportunity for work is concerned. This be a boost to this region. And we've met with the governor's office and had indicated to the governor's office that this is what we would like to do as a borough. And we certainly can use your support in getting the message to the governor's office on that side of the picture. you know, by the revenues that we would receive from the port site, we certainly can apply for water and sewer programs, for police programs, or for the city government programs as well within the region. And certainly we can take some of that load off from the state system by providing those services that state usually provide. And this certainly would be an economic boost to for the Northwest region.
Thanks for that little discussion there, Walter, because I think it's probably a discussion that this committee should look at is what is ADA doing in the state of Alaska to help promote economic development, trade, and tourism throughout the state. Maybe we can invite some of those folks in and talk about what you're doing, you know, with your deepwater port, you know, and Kivalina and stuff like that, and why aren't we doing more?
I guess one thing that you could also look at, really the intent of ADA. What was really the intent of the creation of ADA? As I understand it, was to create a funding source to create an opportunity for those entities that have an interest in creating businesses.
Well, I'll certainly work with Representative Jewell's office on that, and we'll see what we can do.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. The next slide is the port facility that I've been referring to. Those are the two cells, as you can see, where the barges come in to load that source up, to barge out into the ships. And what the hope is for the future is that we're hoping that ADA and DOT will finish off the EIS process for the future development of the deep water port. And the deep water port plans are to dredge about 3 miles out. So the ships, this would be extended about another 2,500 feet out into the ocean, where they would have one of those things that the cranes that were conveyor can be extended out to where the ships can come in and load at the facility. This would cut 200 trips of barging out into the ocean. That certainly would cut down the potential environmental effect into the ocean.
Walter, can you talk a little bit about just to the northeast or just to the right of this photo, what it looks like, the storage sheds there from the dog?
As far as the to the north, as you can see, the facilities right on the white corner there is where the facilities are. Within this area, you will see the tankage for all the fuel that's stored. You will also see just little, probably about a quarter mile back, two large storage facilities for the concentrate. One is one of the largest buildings in the state. Right next to it also is a smaller storage facility. These two storage facilities will hold 9 months work from the mine site into the storage. Within this area, we also have a area where storage area for all the vans are storage for the Red Dog mine. Red Dog storage fuel storage facility holds somewhere about 20 million gallons. Red Dog itself burns on a daily basis of 33,000 gallons a day to keep the operation going. Red Dog is also, along with NANA, looking at drilling for natural gas. Last year, we were able to flare out on one of those hosts. And what we're hoping to do this fall is to bring in larger drills for natural gas right off Red Dog area. Once you get further back into the flats, you will run into the National Park. And Mr. Chairman, that's the extent of my presentation on the port site and the Red Dog mine. I have one other issue I would also like to address with you, if I may, from the Northwest Arctic Borough side. A couple years ago, the Northwest Arctic Borough got interested in creating an opportunity for the arts and crafts in the Northwest region. Right now, arts that are being sent into to the Northwest Arctic Borough is within the borough offices. We do have a space that in consignment, or if we purchase all the artwork for sale that's done within the region are sent into the borough. And sometimes we take in those as in consignment, or we'll purchase some of the artwork. So 2 years ago, we worked with the Chukchi College in applying for a grant to create a art center. And we were able to get the grant of $380,000 from HUD. That's working with the Chukchi College. Well, actually, $395,000, I corrected here. As far as the facility is concerned, NANA had a facility that it wasn't using. The borough went to NANA and got a lease for that property. A facility, I should say. It's an old store we used to have. NANA is leasing that dollar a year to the Northwest Arctic Borough to create an opportunity for the artists to use. With the dollars that the borough received, it's been able to refurbish that facility. It also had purchased some equipment for artists to work with. The borough is working on finalizing the bits and pieces at the facility. It's been renovated, and the inside of it is almost complete. And the hopes is to have an opening in June for arts and crafts for the borough. So if any of the artists within the region that's willing to come to Kotzebue to do some artwork for sale, that facility is in place. That was what we tried to do, was to create an opportunity for the residents of the region, so they can bring in some dollars to provide for their families in the region as well. So I wanted to bring that to your attention. One of the areas that we had some problems with when they were working on the renovating the facility was the water and sewer system was also frozen. So we were able to get additional $106,000 from Rasmussen Foundation to address that problem. So the hopes is to have a good open house in June. So with that, Mr. Chairman, that's the end of my presentation.
Thank you, Walter.
I hope that this quick snapshot that I gave you will give you a picture of what NANA, Tecumseh, as well as the Northwest Arctic Borough has been trying to do as far as creating opportunity for the residents of its region.
Thank you, Walter. Certainly glad to let you come to the committee and do a presentation. And just kind of reverting back to some of the things that we talked about, is how you saw your land as your, I think your words were your local grocery store, you know, or your refrigerator. You went to that, you opened up that door, and you not only found subsistence, but scholarships for your students, employment for your people, and local government and local control. And certainly is very commendable in your goals there. Representative Jewell, would you like to add anything to that or come up and join Walter at all?
Before Representative Jewell comes in, two areas I would also like to address, which I didn't mean to leave out, is the future of the region. What the hope is for the Deepwater Port is to look at, for the future of the region, certainly there's going to be some development north of Red Dog, some other claims of the resources in that area. Also, the coal deposit for the Arctic slope certainly will be an interesting thing for us. That certainly will create an additional opportunity for the residents of the region to work at. The other area that we're certainly looking at is the Ambler Mining District. That's the future of the region. Transportation corridors certainly will have to be looked at, possibly a railroad from Ambler Mining District down to the Deepport facility. These are some of the future things that we certainly will be looking at for the opportunity for the folks in the region.
Thank you, Walter. Reggie, anything to add?
Actually, just thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I think Walter covered most of the stuff. The only part I was going to cover was just the tail end of what Walter included on the port. North of us, about 90 miles from the port site, is the Point Lay coal area. And Arctic Slope Regional Corporation has entered into an agreement with BHP Billiton to take a look at the viability of that project. And so, as Walter described, the EIS that's currently being worked on, you know, the driver here has got to, we've got to keep that EIS project moving forward and not let it get shelved. Because as Walter mentioned, not only does it cut out 200 plus trips a year of lightering by the barges, it would allow for other customers other than Red Dog to come in and potentially use that facility as well, if Arctic Slope and BHP Billiton find that they've got a market for their coal product, and we're able to get the infrastructure done. So, as you can see, the Northwest Arctic, there is a bright spot. It's not without its challenges, but each challenge generally brings a lot of opportunity with it if you're willing to put in the work. And the people at home, as they look at development, it's always with an eye on, we're going to be here after it's all done, and the resources that we depend on for subsistence uses, we need to ensure that they will be here after everybody makes their money and they leave. And so they're very progressive-minded, but it's progressive in the sense that we're going to be there after everybody else develops what they're going to develop.
So it can all work together.
Absolutely.
Walter, if you had any words of advice to give to the folks who are developing the Pebble Mine, what would that be?
Say again, please.
If you had any advice to give to the people who are developing the Pebble Mine, what would that be?
My advice to those folks that are trying to develop the Pebble Mine is to take a step back, to redo their planning process. The way it's going right now, you know, one of those things that I attempted to try to relay the message to management from the company, I said, in order for Pebble Mine to become a mine, you have to start with an attitude of going out and asking people to help. You alone cannot develop such a mine. That means that the company has to go out with information to the communities within that area, within that region, and say, we have an interest in possibly developing this resource. We would like your help. What can you do to help us? This is what we can do for you if you would be willing to partner with us. I think what they did certainly have damaged their reputation, for one. And secondly, the environmentalist group certainly had made their headways on that mine site. But if I was to give my advice to them, take a step back and redo your planning process to include people, to include the environmentalist groups in through the process of planning.
Thank you, Walter. Any questions?
Just a quick question. What is the considered life of the mine right now?
We're looking at another probably about 40 years.
Really?
Yeah.
And you do most of your shipping to China, right?
Korea? It's not only to China. It's all over the world. So Japan, China, Korea. So.
And what barge line do you use for that?
As far as barge line is concerned, that's a Tecumseh question. They do all the negotiations in regards to what ships they get. Last year, there were 26 ships that came into for the port facility.
Thank you. Any other questions? Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative Jewell, Walter Sampson, Vanacorp, for an excellent presentation.
I think,
we all learned a lot on that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Just one additional information for you. Last year, they shipped out a little over a million tons of ore.
I was very impressed with what you're doing with the school district, with your schools.
Thank you very much. You certainly need some good help on that side. So
certainly,
I guess more so to the ADA side. If you folks can pitch in a little bit, say, hey, Governor, direct ADA to start the dialogue on turning the facility over, certainly would help. I mean, that's a relief to the state of Alaska for us, because you know we can start providing with some of the revenues that we would get, we would provide some of those essential services for the communities. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Walter.
Thank you.
And if anybody has any questions too, they can always go through Representative Jewell's office to get a hold of Walter. Now we're going to move on to Senate Bill 97, the Alaska Native Art Identification Seals. We will be using version K.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, can we take about a 5-minute break and come right back? Or 3 minutes?
Is this a 5-minute bill?
I don't think this is going to take a long time.
Just going to get a drink of water?
Go ahead, and we'll just go ahead and maybe start the presentation here. I have asked Walter if he could. I wanted to take advantage of Walter while he was here and kind of give maybe some of his comments on this legislation. I showed it to him earlier. So go ahead, Steve Lampkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Gary Stevens. Unfortunately, Senator Stevens was unable to attend this evening. He's giving me his blessing to present you with the bill. I have a slight slideshow, only if you'd like to see it. It's about 3 minutes, but I'm neutral on the matter. It's just something to look at as I speak, really. But with your indulgence.
Tim, let's go ahead. Maybe that's a good time. Representative Dallas, so let's go ahead.
It's about a 2.5-minute slideshow. Kind of fun. It will put the context of this discussion in clear view.
Could somebody get the light over here?
It might not be necessary.
Stuck there.
Huh? Never mind. Never mind. Okay. Forget that request.
Oh, you got a kind of one of those pirated copies.
Yeah. Okay. It is with great pride that Senator Stevens offered you Senate Bill 97 on behalf of the Alaska State Council of the Arts. Despite its existence for a decade, Mr. Chairman, I venture to say that many people in our great state do not recognize this emblem. It's known simply as the Silver Hand. It's a marketing tool that's used to represent that a piece of art has been authentically made in Alaska by an Alaska native. Its origins date back to at least the 1930s or so, when the market demand for authentic Alaska Native art was clearly increasing. Since that time, there's been a number of efforts to bring credibility to the program that's currently embodied by the Silver Hand, and to honor our Alaska Native artists wishing to sell their wares. Unfortunately, those efforts have been repeatedly thwarted by frauds. A new line of thinking has emerged with some success that puts focus on the artist instead of the art. Senate Bill 97 embraces that effort made by the Arts Council and is truly just a house-cleaning measure that has no motivation other than to modernize the statutes and help strengthen a program that's viable and just needs to be propped up and dusted off, really. Personally, I have 16 years of experience in the private sector of tourism business, specifically out of Fairbanks, where I receive almost daily requests for authentic Native art. Thus, I believe that Senate Bill 97, in conjunction with the efforts of the Arts Council, will help make this emblem much more readily recognizable and even sought for. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to thank you and the committee for taking up this matter. Myself and key members of the program are standing by to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Tim. We do have Saunders McNeil from Alaska State Council on Arts for questions if we need him. Tim, does this in any way change the bloodline lineages? I believe it was at 25% that you need to have to sell Alaska Native arts. Does this change that at all?
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that that's correct. It would strike references to blood quantum and bring the language for permit holders in line or in sync with existing federal levels. But Ms. McNeil can address that as well.
I have had some concerns about that, or heard concerns from the Native community on that, and the thought that that would weaken the total effect of what they're trying to get at here with, you know, fully Alaskan arts here. So maybe we can, maybe we'll ask Mr. Sampson his opinion on that. Right now, we do have Benjamin Brown. Let's hear from Benjamin real quick from Alaska State Council on the Arts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Benjamin Brown. I'm an attorney who lives here in Juneau. I'm from Anchorage. I'm the vice chairman of the State Council on the Arts, and this is a consensus, not consensus, it was actually unanimously endorsed by the members of the council after being prepared by a committee of Alaska Native artists, two of whom serve on the council, Sven Hawkinson, the chairman from the Aleutic Museum and Cultural Repository in Kodiak. He's from Old Harbor originally and is an artist as well as an arts advocate and a curator of a great little museum there. And Teresa John, who's a member from Bethel, who teaches Native dance and is a professor at the university campus out there. Perry Eaton was also on the task force that looked at the statute and really tried to make, as Mr. Lampkin said, some targeted house cleaning changes to it. Certainly not seeking to engender any controversy. Some changes were already made to make sure the language was no stronger in tone or effect than it need be before the legislation left the Senate. And I think the council would just be very grateful if you would consider it on its merits at this point, and hopefully we can get it enacted rather sooner than later this year. It's a small part of what we do on the council, but it's an important part of the council's work.
Benjamin, and some of the questions that have came up with changes that were made to the terms Alaskan tribe is instead of Native art. And when I was, some of the other, I had three or four emails from folks, again, not concerned just about the lineages.
Where are you on the bill? You have some?
I'm on page 4, Representative.
Page 4, thank you.
But when we're talking, in fact, we'll go to page 4, section 6 of a new paragraph that reads, state resident. This would mean that somebody who is an Alaska Native through lineage of one way or another, and maybe lived outside of the state of Alaska, could not produce and sell Alaska art. to be sold in the state?
Mr. Chairman, actually, if they're not physically present in the state, intent to return to the state and remain indefinitely permits them to be participants in the program. So it would be kind of like getting a dividend when you were away at school. It wouldn't be a bar to participation.
Gentlemen, Walter, would you like to make some comments on this?
I had a question for him.
Representative Gatto had a question for who?
Ben.
That's Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I had a question for Ben.
Yeah. Go ahead.
If Native were to make an ulu,
where
would the steel come from?
As a matter of fact, one of the changes made by this bill is it allows use of not just traditional materials, but more modern materials in the creation of Native art. So the steel could come from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, or anywhere else. The free market brought it up to Alaska to be used in the artwork. But it's not just steel that this actually permits of. It's all sorts of media that are more and more frequently being used in the creations of Alaska Native art. So something even more traditional like steel would be permitted, but plastics, or bless you, Representative Dugan. If you look at Alvin Amundsen, you know, some of his three-dimensional paintings, I mean, those are acrylic paints, but they're still certainly Alaska Native art.
If I may add to that, Mr. Chairman, that's part of the thrust of the new line of thinking where they'd like to put more emphasis these days on the artist rather than the piece of art itself.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Lampkin. Walter, please state your name again for the record.
Walter Sampson, Native Regional Corporation. Mr. Chairman, I had a quick overview of the amendments that were written. Certainly, I don't have no problems in strengthening the silver hand law that's in place. The symbol is good, but the amendments to
By
include
amendments, you mean the changes that were
yeah
made.
The changes that are being made, certainly in regards to the tribal issue. You're narrowing down the Native issue, which is a statewide issue, down to a tribe. In fact, when you get down to the blood quantum, then certainly I have some problems with that. I think by doing that, certainly it's going to become a divisive issue at some point in time. And for people, or for some of the natives that also have some good gifts or gifted in being artists as well as being making crafts, if an individual, if I have a son in Arizona that is an artist that can make, that can produce, but yet is a tribal member or the native of Alaska, he would not be able to sell his artwork from Arizona. But yet he's still a native. That I have a problem with. Anytime you start making amendments or changes to the intent of the law, sometimes when you convolute that, the intent of it certainly changes. So those are my comments, Mr. Chairman. I guess if you have any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Sampson? Thank you, Walter. Mr. Lampkin, you want to respond to any of that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In response to a humble response of the words that I respect from Mr. Sampson, I'd like to clarify that the artist in Arizona would in no way be prohibited from selling his or her art. It just would simply be limited that artist not use the silver hand emblem on that art when it's sold.
I think that was probably understood. I understood.
I think the difficulty that we might be trying to embrace here is defining who should qualify for this program. And on that note, I'd like to defer to Ms. McNeil.
We will hear from Ms. McNeil. And just because I have heard a substantial amount of what I feel substantial, three pages of probably at least a half a dozen natives of Native Alaskans, discussions with Mr. Sampson, I think we'll probably hold this bill for today, but we will hear from McNeil for now, since she's here, if she has any comment.
Hello, this is Saunders McNeil. Thank you for taking the time to consider Senate Bill 97. There are a couple different things that have come up in the discussion that I think need some clarification. The first one would be the use of the Silverhand permit outside of the state of Alaska. And in large part, the reason that we would like to require individuals be represented or be residents of the state of Alaska is that we have no enforcement jurisdiction in any other state. So in order to provide any kind of enforcement services through our partnerships with the Attorney General's Office, the Federal Trade Commission, the Indian Arts and Crafts Board, we have no jurisdiction within outside of our state boundaries. That's the first thing. The second thing is...
McNeil?
Yes.
So would that prohibit Mr. Sampson? It was a hypothetical son that he was talking about. So that he could not ship his material back up here and sell it in the Solantic Art Center then?
The intent of the program always has been that work is done by Alaska Natives who are residents of the state and that they're actually making their work in the state. There have been some interesting exceptions to that. For example, if somebody is stationed in the military and they're basically doing service to the state and the country, and they're producing work outside of the state. But at this point, the intent of the program is that Alaska Native artists who are producing their artwork are actually producing it in the state. So, for example, with Mr. Sampson's son, if he returned to the state, then he would be eligible for a Silverhand permit.
I think we understand that. Representative Lynn has a question.
Well, I at one time I sold photographs at the Saturday Market, and I had a Made in Alaska permit, which I put on my note cards and so on. How is this different between the Made in Alaska little bear symbol thing and the hand? How do you differentiate? Would somebody at Silverhand also have the Made in Alaska symbol? Would it be both? I think I know the difference, but please spell it out so I'm crystal clear on this.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sure the other members present would have a comment as well, but it's my understanding Made in Alaska is in general used for mass-produced manufactured goods. It can also be several artists that have both the Silverhand and Made in Alaska, but those people that perhaps are artists that would not qualify for Silverhand could also go to Made in Alaska. Mechanically, this is in the Department of Education. Made in Alaska is in the Department of Commerce. There are other distinctions as well. Mrs. McNeil, I'm sure, will be happy to.
Thank you.
The Made in Alaska brand is owned by the Department of Ag, the state of Alaska. It owns that trademark. Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think what I heard was that we don't have any jurisdiction outside the state of Alaska.
Yes, that's correct, with the Silverhand permit.
There's nothing to prevent somebody who's living in Arizona from slapping a silver hand on that baby and selling it. Am I correct in understanding that?
Yes, as far as kind of having sort of foot soldiers on the ground to do site visits all over the country, that's exactly right.
Huh. Copyright?
So, but that, in my mind, in regard to the changes to the statute, is a whole sort of another issue around Native arts authentication, both within the state of Alaska and certainly nationally. But the statutes proposed today, there's still, I think, some points of clarification that might be important to make, if I may, is that?
Quickly.
Okay. For example, the blood quantum issue. The Alaska State Council on the Arts, our role, our job, is to administer the Silver Hand Permit Program. Our job, ultimately, is not to say who is Native and who is not, that we are in deference to tribes within the state. If tribes say that they have a member or they designate somebody as a member of their tribe, then this Alaska State Council on the Arts would defer to that. And what we would require then from a permit holder would be proof that they are a registered member of a tribe. So in as far as the issue that Mr. Sampson brought up, that the deference is to the tribe. So if the tribe says that they have members, no matter sort of who those members are, we defer to the tribes. And I think those are the two, kind of the two primary points that were of concern.
Thank you, Ms. McNeil. Any questions for Ms. McNeil? Representative Dahl?
Yes, I just need to have something clarified. Going back to that example of the Nulu, and then on page 5, where you said original meaning new, unique, not a reproduction, or without the use of a mechanized duplication instruments. If we're bringing, were you mentioning, Mr. Brown, that, for example, we could import the steel that's already fashioned, and then the wood would be already there, and you just have to put it together? Is that the idea, or what?
Representative Dahl, for the chair, that wasn't what I was trying to address at all. I was trying to address the diversity of media, of, you know, materials that are used in the creation of real significant Alaska Native art that you see in public places and private residences and museums around the state. Some of you may have some of it in your offices via the Art Bank program. You know, it's a fine line whether something is a handicraft or an art. This statutory, this bill seeks to streamline the statute so it refers to artwork. Some ulus are pieces of artwork, absolutely. I think it's an almost endless spectrum of analysis whether or not a certain amount of carving on a handle of an ulu with a prefabricated handle turns it into art. So and that's certainly not the sort of micromanagement the program wants to get into. What the program wants to do is identify Alaska Natives who create art mostly in Alaska. And I think when Ms. McNeil was talking earlier about someone being outside, I think if someone were sending their work back to be sold in Alaska, it's likely that staff would find a way to issue them a silver hand permit because the enforcement issue would cease to exist if the art were for sale here. But at any rate, it's to find people that are creating art. And if they're using one piece that's already a sharpened blade, I don't know that means they don't qualify.
And Mr. Lampkin, therein lies some of the confusion is why I would like to have a little discussion on this, and I'd like to do a little bit of research on it myself and a little discovery. As you said, well, if Mr. Sampson's son lived in Arizona, and you'd probably find a way to do it. Well, that's just what you said, Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Looking at this definition, if Chuna McIntyre were still painting paintings, the original painting we'd be able to put a silver hand on it, but the prints from the painting would not get a silver hand. Is that correct?
Ms. McNeil may be able to answer that. The issue of printmaking has come up, and I don't believe that creating prints from an original, like Remigneaux's does, or Chuna McIntyre, is considered a fully mechanized process because of the coloration of the individual prints from the painting. So Ms. McNeil, do you have a more definite answer for Representative Dugan?
Yeah, which is I don't know if it will clarify or not, but there's certain types of printing. So the intent here is that there's a direct relationship between each piece of work and the artist. So, for example, let's say you have Chuna McIntyre, who maybe he's doing a woodblock work, and he makes a limited edition run of prints from that, and he is the printmaker of that. That would certainly be eligible under the new statutes as a silver hand item. What would not be would be, let's say he did a painting, and then he had another printing company print 100,000 prints that are basically manufactured. He could then apply for, if he so chose, to the Made in Alaska program, which is basically a manufactured item. And honestly, each of these sort of are certainly case-by-case basis, and the hope with the change in the statutes is they are sort of overarching changes that improve the program and actually make the program more inclusive of all Native artists, regardless of those artists working in a traditional art form or a contemporary art form.
Representative Goddard, did you have a question?
I have a statement. You're probably familiar with Alaska Grown, and that has gone through several variations of lawsuits, and whether the state owns it or Department of Agriculture or the farmers themselves. Just a thought about patenting the silver hand and whether or not you have some idea on how to protect it from use, because I think Walmart wanted to buy a whole bunch of shirts from China that had the Alaska Grown logo, and they could certainly sell them for $11 instead of $30. And that issue has popped up, and I think it's been resolved in favor of the farmers, but it's probably not completely resolved yet, and so a caution.
If I may respond to that through the chair, Representative.
Quickly.
Okay. In fast answer to that question, and it's a great question. The Silver Hand emblem is actually trademarked in the state, so it has a registered trademark. And basically, how that trademark works is that the Alaska State Council on the Arts is responsible for the emblem, and we provide what's considered limited use to the Silver Hand permit holders. So under state law and state jurisdiction, the image is protected, and we're in the process of getting a federal trademark. And by doing that, we have both protections on a state level and a federal level.
Thank you, Ms. McNeil. And is there any more public testimony on this? Okay. Representative Gatto's mentioned several times in some of our committees here that he likes to hear from the people who are affected by this, too. I'd like to hear a little bit more from some of our artisans in the state on what they think of this and how it should be affected. With that, I will try and contact them, or my office will. I'd like to thank this committee for the work that they've done this year. We've always managed to we've always filled up this table up here, even if it's at 7 or 8 o'clock at night, and I certainly respect that from my committee members. Thank you for what you've done. I'm not quite sure if we're going to be able to have any more meetings this year or not. We're going to the 24-hour rule. We'll see what we can do to try and find some people on this issue, and maybe we can still resolve that this year. It is a Senate bill, but I believe we have until the 12th.
I'd just like to state, Mr. Chair, that art by its nature is unique. That's what makes art art. It's one of a kind, unique. You understand that as a cabinet maker, each artist, each whatever human being is unique too, and artist, and several elements of uniqueness, and being race, or being this race or that race, native or not native, that's just another aspect of uniqueness. We're all unique.
Thank you, Representative Lynn. And with that, we have any other comments from committee members? That will close today's hearing. It is 7:17.
8:18. 8:18.